Well, thank you for your very warm welcome, and also Mr. Tate for rearranging the programme. I have a very important funeral tomorrow, and Mr. Tate very kindly agreed, and Mr. Philip to rearrange things, and I'm greatly indebted to them. The Glen, as everyone knows, is in Scotland. There is only one Glen. It's Glenurquhart. In the Highlands, when folk talk about the Glen, it's not Glenafric, it's Glenurquhart. But this talk has nothing to do with Glenurquhart, or little to do with Glenurquhart. The purpose will emerge eventually. Now, Mr. Tate asked me to speak on the whole area of church growth. And really, I thought that was a little bit flat and a little bit, in a sense, passé. Because when you think about church growth, you think of the whole McGavern thing, you know, the homogeneous growth principle and all that sort of stuff. Now, there is a sense in which that is yesterday's story. And as so many of these things are, it's moved on. And so today I'm really going to talk about Willow Creek and its effect on Scotland. And there is a sense in which Willow Creek is also passé. Some of the folks in North America say, well, we've moved on from Willow Creek. And that also is yesterday's story. A brief poll. Can I ask you to put up your hand if you were at the Bill Hybels talk a few weeks ago? Don't be scared. Nobody's taking notes or no cameras. Okay, thank you. Right. Let me put this scenario to you. It's February, it's the bleak midwinter, it's raining outside, and you are a little bit depressed. And when you arrived 3 years ago, you had a regular congregation of, say, 80 people. There have been a few deaths, and a few folk have moved on. And now, really, in 3 years, you've not seen any growth. On the contrary, you've seen a decline. There are now only 60 people attending your services. And so the Kirk session meets that evening. And you are meeting with the session and you're looking at them and you're saying, come on folks, let's have ideas. You're looking at where you are as a congregation and you want to move on. And you say, let's have some ideas. And as soon as you've said that, you wish you'd never even have spoken. There's Ronnie there. Now Ronnie talks about the good old days 30 years ago when the Reverend McTavish was there and they had magic lantern talks for the kids. And they used to have 300 children in and they used to have scones and jams afterwards and it was absolutely brilliant. You know, however, that the local coal mine has closed down and that there aren't even 300 children in the parish anymore. There's only 100. But Ronnie still goes on about the good old days. And that's his idea. He says, let's get the Good News Club revived again. Let's get these things going. And then you turn to John, and John says, let's just plough on. He says rather enigmatically, the last man tried to change everything, and look where he is today, staring at the new incumbent. And so he looks at Paul. Now, Paul is a little bit more proactive. He pulls out a pile of tracts that he's just got through the post from the really Protestant Truth Society, identifying the latest wolves in the scene. And he is saying, this is the way forward. We must distribute these things. And then he turns to Leonard. And Leonard has just read the recent edition of the Catholic Herald, and he's read that liturgical dance is all the rage, and really, that's the path that we should go down. Well, that's the poor man's Kirk session. Now, that scenario is not unknown to many folk, I'm sure, in this room. We recognize there is a problem. We have a desire in our heart to see the Church of God grow. And we ask the people round about us, how can we accomplish this? And we get all sorts of ideas. Well, you go back to the manse, you're deflated and you're demotivated. And then all of a sudden on the coffee table, you see a rather glossy leaflet. And suddenly your heart rises. You have discovered Willow Creek. The future has arrived. And so in the midst of the bleak February gloom, you pick up this marvelous piece of literature and you start to read and your heart
is very strangely warmed as you read about all these amazing things. In it, you read about an amazing church where in 1975 there were 100 teenagers, and now every weekend there are 15,000 people worshipping in that church. And the amazing thing is that the pastor is coming over the States, from the States to Scotland, and he says that we too can be like him. The credit card is out before we can say in hunc effectum. We have filled in an application form, and our tickets are booked. Now again, the scenario is typical. You struggle, but again, the guy down the road doesn't struggle. And so often we ask and we come into a real sense of deflation. What does he have that I don't have? Where am I going wrong in this situation? Now, my aim today is to lead a discussion into the nature of church growth. And I want to look at the background of Willow Creek because it's in the news just now. And I want to apply it and interpret it within the Scottish context. Hence the title, Viewing the Creek from Down the Glen. That's the sort of idea behind the enigmatic title. And I want to ask the question, get some feedback from yourselves. What is true church growth? And how, or indeed, can we work towards it? What I want to do, two things. I want to do, first of all, the Willow Creek described. And then, secondly, I want to do a critique of Willow Creek. And I'm going, that's a rhyming, isn't it? A critique of Willow Creek. I want to look, first of all, at the positive elements, and then secondly, at the negative elements, interweaving, hopefully, Scottish church culture within these strands. First of all, then, for those of you who are the uninitiated, the Willow Creek described. What are we talking about here? What sort of body is this? First of all, then, the history. Well, Willow Creek Community Church is, as you would expect in the USA, it's in South Barrington, Illinois. And it's regarded as the second largest church in the US and according to some observers in the States, the most influential church in North America. And I think that's pretty near the mark, the most influential church in North America. And now folk in Scotland, it's going out of fashion in the States and is now in fashion in Scotland. More and more folk are attracted to it. It began, strangely enough, with a youth ministry. The youth ministry of South Park Church in Park Ridge, Illinois. The church wanted to start a second service with a more contemporary feel. And so the new service was led significantly by the musical director and the pianist. They were the pioneers of the second service. And so the idea is that you had your traditional first thing in the morning, and then you had your real singing and dancing, moving and shaking second service, which was going to be geared for young people. Now, after the rehearsal for the music group, a Bible study was started, led by a guy called Bill Hybels, who is the present pastor. Now, later, the music was separated from the Bible study time, and a whole new concept was born. It was the concept of a multimedia presentation of the gospel, where the kids could invite their friends, where it would be, in the best sense of the word, user-friendly. Now, within 6 months, the meeting grew to over 300, and after a few years, 1,000 turned up, and then 1,500, and so it grew. The budget was $300, and then it grew to $80,000. And as the event grew, the service was split into two. There was what became known as the seeker service. That was for folk who were unconverted, who were unchurched even. They wouldn't, I think, use the language conversion initially. So you had your seeker service, and then midweek, you had another service for those who were already disciples, or those who required discipleship. And the rest, as I say, is history. It is an absolutely massive church with an incredibly vast complex, and it looks more like a shopping mall or a theatre than a church. Now, really what it is the baptism of the American dream. I think that's what the whole Willow Creek philosophy is. And very often that's what the church growth philosophy is. It is the American dream baptized. You know, you've got your homesteaders and your pioneers. And some ministers are just homesteaders. But the guys who are really going to go somewhere are the pioneers, and they are the folk who boldly go where no man has gone before. And so Willow Creek has arrived. Someone who went to Willow Creek wrote this. They said, Martin Robinson, who's written a British sort of flavoured version of the Willow Creek story, he says, I suspect that what really attracts people at this unusual church is not something that can be captured very easily on paper. I can perhaps start to describe this X factor by calling it a kind of raw energy. It is this raw creative drive that has allowed the unusual to happen. That's it. Raw creative drive. Is that what we need as we hurl towards the millennium? Is that what's at the very nucleus of your congregational board or your Kirk session? Are you in amongst bodies who are pulsating with this raw creative drive? Well, in 1977, they bought 90 acres of prime land, and later the campus expanded to 127 acres. This is a big place. They have athletics facilities, soft seats, cafe areas, the lot. So that then is a brief thumbnail, a sketch of the Willow Creek history. Secondly, what about the Willow Creek philosophy? What phrase could we use about Willow Creek or of Willow Creek? Well, most of the critics use one phrase, and it's very accurate. They say it's a market-driven church. That's very important. I think that's at the center of the Willow Creek philosophy. The market-driven church, where there is a consumer who has been identified and named. The church aims to reach someone that Willow Creek call Unchurched Harry. That's what they call them. Unchurched Harry is the people group, the homogeneous unit that they are trying to reach. Who is Unchurched Harry? He's male, obviously. He's professional. He's aged 25 to 40. He's married. He's disenchanted with conventional church. He's middle income, middle class. He is, in other words, a yuppie. But that, in a sense, is part of the problem of Willow Creek, in that it's targeting a group which no longer exists. Because the yuppie has disappeared. Generation X, indeed, has disappeared. The baby boomer is passé, as the sociologists tell us. But the problem is that churches like Willow Creek are almost inextricably linked to one particular group. You see this in the States in a sort of crystal a cathedral type, who are really Willow Creek 20 years on. They have grey hair, whereas in Willow Creek there is dark hair. But they're linked to a certain particular group. Now, there is a sense in which Bill Hybels is the same type. The pastor is the same type of person that the church is reaching. And that, again, you see very often in church growth thinking, in that the pastor attracts the same type as himself. Hybel says, generally, a pastor can define his appropriate target audience by determining with whom he would like to spend a vacation or an afternoon of recreation. So Hybel says, you go for the folk you like. If you would like to spend a holiday with them, you therefore go for them. They are the target group of your own congregation. Someone said, quote, Hybels in a business suit looks less like a clergyman than an executive commuting to the Chicago Loop. And then we've got to ask ourselves, well, isn't there something wrong here? You minister basically to the folk you like. Wasn't there all this stuff about prostitutes and publicans and sinners and something about being born in a stable and incarnation and sin and suffering? Isn't the world not a little bit more tacky than Hybels would perhaps suggest? But Hybel says, look, the first step to reaching people is to understand them. And so what Willow Creek say is, and they have a whole a group called the Willow Creek Association, what they say is, what you do is you conduct a survey and you ask folk, why do you stay away from church? And it's very simple. What you do is you get a list of the reasons for staying away from church, and you create a church which has none of these things in them. So therefore, there are no obstacles in coming to church. And then they were asked, well, if these obstacles were removed, would you come to church? And so what they developed was the seeker service. And the key of evangelism, according to Willow Creek, is to be consistently and constantly seeker-friendly. Now, in a seeker service, there is no worship. There is a multimedia presentation. There is contemporary music and drama. Hybels would preach for about 30, 35 minutes. A fairly big sermon, but the sermon... depends where you come from, 35 minutes, being a big sermon right enough. But what Hybels would say is that it's a bit like the souffle that we had today. Really non-threatening, very, very easy. Easy to be digested. Don't talk too much about sin. Don't talk too much about the barbed edge of the gospel and the elements of commitment. And so Willow Creek has this ethos of being nice, of being cloudy, if you like, of being really, really soft, user-friendly. Everything is designed to make you, the consumer, comfortable and at ease. They're also into excellence. Willow Creek, Willow Creek has 10 core values. And one of the core values of Willow Creek is core value 8. We believe that excellence honors God and inspires people. So they pursue excellence. You will not smell kirky smells in Willow Creek. You will not hit the whiff of mothballs or dampness. Nothing is old. Everything is smooth, new. It works, which is really new for churches. Each service is an event, a massive car park. Recently, a big name speaker, it took an hour and a half for the car park to empty. And the emphasis is on just looking. The sermons should not force anyone into making a decision. It shouldn't be very, very threatening, very pragmatic. And the apologetic, Hybels actually said, the apologetic is this, does it work? Because you work from that pragmatic assumption, if something works, it must be true. Whereas I would suggest that Scripture says the exact opposite. First of all, it is true, therefore it works. But he's putting the cart before the horse. And so church is a very painless experience. In Illinois, a businessman might say, let's do church. Just the same as he'd say, let's do lunch. Because it's just an experience. It's just one of those things that everyone in the Chicago area, they've got to do church. They've got to go along to Willow Creek. And so you've got the folk that go along to the seeker-sensitive service. They are introduced to some Christian concepts. And then if you become a Christian or if you show interest in discipleship, you're moved on to the second service, which is called the New Community Service. Now, that's a service to meet the needs of believers. And they have, it's just an ordinary church, worship, teaching, communion once per month. They also stress small groups. The core value 7 is, we believe that life changing happens best in small groups. And it's, again, strongly relational. That's another Willow Creek buzzword, relational. It's trying to cure alienation, not alienation from God in the first instance, but alienation with each other, trying to cure the angst of the normal yuppie. And small groups, they argue, I think correctly, in many areas, help this sort of thing along. And then after that, there is an involvement in ministry, core value 5. We believe that a church should operate as a unified community of servants with men and women stewarding their spiritual gifts. So you see the whole pattern. It's very well organized. From seeker sensitive, you move into the new community, you're taught, you go into your small groups, you're involved in ministry, and you, the ordinary person in the street, begins to minister to others. Nothing wrong with that. At least superficially. So that then is Willow Creek described. Now, secondly, I want to look at the Willow Creek model analysed. And I want to hear some feedback afterwards. What do you folk think of the whole philosophy? Is it right? Is it wrong? Is this the line we should be going down? I want to, and I think there will be some discussion here. The Willow Creek model analysed. Is it valid church growth? Well, we can only gauge if it is valid in biblical church growth if we set up a benchmark in asking ourselves, what constitutes church growth? You asked yourself that. You want your church to grow, marvelous, but the fundamental question is, what constitutes church growth? Now, the classic definition of church growth must be not Donald McGovern, but Luke, Acts 16:5. So the churches were strengthened in the faith and grew daily in numbers. And so there is this twin-track approach. As the people of God are strengthened in their faith, as they have new insights into the transcendence of God and His holiness, as they begin to want to know God and be strong, as they begin to see their hearts being enlarged in worship and adoration, as they gasp in wonder, love, and praise at the magnificence of the gospel and the grace of God. Surely that is part of what strengthening our faith means. And then surely also we ought to be looking for growth numerically. And this is seen in at least two other passages, Acts 2:47. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. And the interesting thing there is, that's Acts 2, the description of the church there is not really Willow Creek. And they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and in the fellowship and in breaking of bread and in the prayers. Willow Creek would say, no, no, that's the wrong model. But it's out of that fourfold model, these fourfold marks of the church, according to Acts 2, that we find that phrase, the Lord added to their number daily. Acts 9:31. Then the church throughout Judea, Galilee, and Samaria enjoyed a time of peace. It was strengthened and encouraged by the Holy Spirit. It grew in numbers, living in the fear of the Lord. So, we had someone preaching in our church recently, and there was absolutely, it was more than packed. Always is when someone else is preaching. It was absolutely more than packed. And one of our deacons who works in the retail industry, the folk were coming in. And I says, "Ali, what do we do? Stack 'em and rack 'em." Is not that sometimes simplistically the view of church growth? Stack 'em and rack 'em. Get 'em in. The bigger the better. The more the merrier. Now, some of us come from a tradition which is suspicious of numbers. And almost perhaps subliminally they say that the full church is the suspect church. Now, I don't hold to that automatically. But there is the other view which says that the full church is the living church. How far does Willow Creek measure up to this definition of church growth according to Acts 16:5, 2:47, 9:31? And is this what Scotland needs? Let's look firstly at the negative elements of Willow Creek. Negative element number one is it doesn't work. At least, it's not as effective as they say it is. Let's use the model of the States, and there are parallels in Britain. Folks from the States here this afternoon, but the statistics say that in the USA there has been a decline in evangelicals in real terms in the last 25 years. And yet there has been the growth of the mega churches. You've got the famous ones, Anaheim Vineyard, Calvary Chapel, even some of the big Presbyterian churches now are mega churches. What's a mega church? The people who are into this define it, a mega church as one attended by over 1,000+ people. In 1972, there were 100 churches, around about 100 churches in the States, which were called mega churches, attended by 1,000+ people. Now there are 4,000 mega churches. So is there revival in the States? Well, the statisticians tell us that the number of small churches is decreasing as the number of the larger is increasing. And 50% of believers attend 7% of the churches. And in the States, 90% of the churches have fewer than 200 people attending on a Sunday morning. That is the picture. George Barna writes in a classic phrase. He says, churches are growing by the rearranging of the saints. Evangelicals are simply playing musical churches, moving around to more exciting, larger churches. The mega church's feeding system is a smaller church and disgruntled believers who have quit their churches. Even in Willow Creek, only 15% of the folk who attend seeker-sensitive services are unchurched Harrys. I read a recent review recently that said that most of the people are what they call superficially churched Larrys. There is some connection with the evangelical world. Now, there are folk here from all over Scotland and to a certain extent all over the world. Does this model of big churches getting bigger as smaller churches get smaller, does it fit into the Scottish scene? This is where I want to hear some folks speaking later. All my ministry, 14 years, has been in Inverness. which, as my colleagues from Inverness here will confirm, is one of the most church towns in Scotland. And the churches, I don't remember Glasgow trams, but folks say that the church scene in Inverness is just like that, like Glasgow trams. You go along and you jump off one and get in the other one, and you go along for a few miles and then jump off. And as I observe the scene, what I am witnessing are that there are very few converts from the world. And as some of our churches, and I include myself, grow, they have grown at the expense, to a certain extent, of other surrounding churches. In my own situation, my church is in suburbia, which is classic, fertile church growth area. But roundabout, I know that my church is affecting my colleague in Croy up the road, in a little village in Ardiseer, and even as far as Nairn. Because what you have is, you have young families, and they go to a church with the best intention, and they find that they are sitting, and they look around, and there are 20 people, they're old, the building is dark, it's damp, there is just no atmosphere. And these families want their children to be exposed to a bit of life. And so they go along for a few weeks, and then they say, we just can't do this anymore, and they go to the larger unit where they stay. Is that your story? And so it's very difficult to cope with such a situation. If you're a minister in one of these rural places, and you're hearing all the time, well, down the road's full, down the road's lively, it's not comparing like with like, because you're not down the road. And so I'm saying that the Willow Creek model, firstly, it doesn't work. At least it's not as effective as they say. To a certain extent, some churches grow, but if we take the whole picture, the national picture, it has no effect, if you pardon it, in a sort of crass, cold way, of the statistical or the statistics of the national picture. Secondly, and this is by no means original, all the books say that, Carson, Wells, it worships at the altar of pragmatism. The dominant idea is, how far can our church be shaped to meet the needs of the world? And so Hybels would say, look, hold on with the appeal. Choose you this day whom you will serve. As he looks at the church of God, the minister announces with passion, turn ye, why will you die? He pleads with sinners to come to Christ. He is preaching for today as dying men to dying men. And he appeals to them in Christ's name to be reconciled with God. I was to say, come on, hold on. It's too heavy. And yet we see folk going on their way to a lost eternity in hell. We do not know the minute. And they say, look at this dramatic sort of fundamentalist stuff from last century. Hold on. But the enormity of the issues of life and death, I feel, are not being dealt with adequately in the Willow Creek model. There was an article in Newsweek. This was a secular article, and it compared the religion, the interest in religion in Willow Creek compared to the Great Awakening. And this is what Newsweek said. The aim this time is support, not salvation. Help rather than holiness. A circle of spiritual equals rather than an authoritative church or guide. Sometimes the small group study. I remember I was once in Tom Swanson's study. Just after a year, I came, and Tom was talking about a certain group of people who met together to share God's word, and he said, a sharing of ignorance. Was that cruel? Sometimes it's like that. You see, there is no sense of this authoritative guide. Thus says the Lord. The article continues, a group affirmation of self is at the top of the agenda, which is why some of the least demanding churches are now in greatest demand. In their efforts to accommodate, many clergy have simply airbrushed sin out of their language. Like politicians, they can only speak about mistakes. You've seen an airbrushed picture. It's almost like a photograph. And with computerization these days, you can really do anything with these techniques. And so what I would argue that Willow Creek has done largely is it's airbrushed out sin. Now, Willow Creek would say that's not the case. That's unfair. They've produced a paper entitled Myths About a Movement. And they say that's one of the myths about seeker sensitivity. They say that the single most important myth about Willow Creek is that they preach a watered-down gospel. Willow Creek would say, and I think Bill Hybels, I hope is he here? I don't think he is. He would say, no, I don't do that. Now, I believe that Bill Hybels is very sincere. We're not talking charlatan here. I think those of you who saw the man, to a certain extent, he is not a charlatan. One of their core values is this, and this is a core value which I like, and I'll be speaking about it later. One of the core values is to be culturally relevant while remaining doctrinally pure. Now, to me, if Willow Creek has done nothing, one thing it has done is that it's brought that core value onto our agenda. To be culturally relevant while remaining doctrinally pure. I have no objection with the Willow Creek core value. It's core value 3. The problem is in the application. John MacArthur observes. He says, an overpowering surge of ardent pragmatism is sweeping through evangelicalism in his book Ashamed of the Gospel. Traditional methodology, most notably preaching, is being discarded or downplayed in favour of newer means such as drama, dance, comedy, variety, sideshow histrionics, pop psychology, and other entertainment forms. The newer methods, MacArthur says, are supposedly more effective. That is, they draw a bigger crowd. And since for many the chief criterion for gauging the success of a church has become attendance figures, whatever pulls in the most people is accepted without critical analysis as being good. That is pragmatism. The problem for me with Willow Creek is that the medium is the message. My problem is that in Willow Creek, the medium is the massage. Because that's what it's doing. The very medium is contradicting the message. Now, the pursuit of excellence is laudable. And I think churches need to take on board the pursuit of excellence. Instead of picking up the phone and someone saying, hi, I'm about to throw something out. Is there anything you could use it for in the church? I don't want to hear that sort of thing. I like my church to be painted. I like the seats to be clean. I like the windows to be clean. I like a photocopier that works. I like all these things. I don't like things breaking down. That's good. But Willow Creek says the pursuit of excellence is more than that. And then I read 1 Corinthians 1:26 following, that speaks about the foolishness of preaching over against the methodology of these super apostles in Corinth. Paul says, I didn't come with wise or persuasive words. Surely the man who preaches a crucified Savior must of necessity be a crucified man. Willow Creek would say he's got to be self-actualized. The thick pile carpets are miles away from the manger and the stigmata of the early gospel. There is a sense in which the Christian faith is a counterculture. We are calling men to take up the women to take up the cross and follow him. You remember Jesus in John 6, verse 66. He is speaking that amazing thing. Whoever will come after me, let him take up his cross, let him deny himself and follow me. NIV says, from this time, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. The Gaelic Bible, which of course is far more accurate than the NIV or even the AV, translates that, for this reason, and that is translating the original word far more accurately. For this reason, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. They weren't offended by the fact that churches took money and that you had to sing in churches. They were offended by the fact that they had to renounce and repent of their sin. And they said, this isn't for me, Jesus. And many turned back and no longer followed him. Now, the implications of the gospel have to be explained. Willow Creek say, provide an inoffensive environment. Give freedom, tolerance, and anonymity. Don't be preachy and authoritative. Keep the folks entertained. I have a friend who works in Portland, Oregon, and he sent me an email yesterday about a new ministry in the States, a clown, Christian clown. Get this guy along, and the blurb said, this guy is side-splitting. He has folk literally rolling in the aisles. I'm sure. Third critique. Will Creek offers, and again this is by no means original, models, personalities, and contexts which cannot be transferred. There is no doubt about the gifts of Bill Hybels. I think if Bill Hybels was in business, he'd be a millionaire. Because the guy is gifted. He's a communicator. He's an organizer. He is focused. He is incredibly gifted. And he is someone who can really get things going. He's the sort of man who would do well in any area of life. He's a driven man, Bill Hull writes in Power Religion. He says, their personality and gifts cannot be folded up, placed in a box with wrapping paper, and sent home for the price of registration. The danger of this sort of model is, Bill Hull says, that we're drawn into impersonation. And he gives the illustration of an Elvis impersonator. Now, I've never seen an Elvis impersonator in the flesh, but I'm sure it's a very sad sight if someone tries to imitate the king. Someone who tries to be like Elvis, it ends up to be a caricature. We cannot copy Willow Creek. We do not have the resources. And not only do we cannot. 1 Corinthians 11:1. Paul said, follow my example as I follow the example of Christ. We are not surely to imitate a package, but Christ and covet holiness for ourselves. At the end of the day, it will be truth which will win people, and we've got to pass on the faith once delivered to the saints. Willow Creek, we say, yeah, I want that. You take Bill Hybels, you put him in Garthamlock, and you say, Bill, build a church. you take him down to one of the hardest places in Scotland and you say, right, the job's yours. Do it. Now, I think he'd be struggling. Are there not some areas? What do you think about this idea? Are there not some areas in Scotland which are spiritually hard? Where I live, east of Inverness, is notoriously spiritually hard. Nairnshire, central Murrayshire, inland Banff and Buchan, Gordon, the southwest of Scotland. Is it true to say that even sometimes you have villages that are hard? Folk have always said that about, for instance, the village of Strathpether, strangely enough, where the convention used to be held. It's an incredibly gospel-hard place. And yet it's surrounded by areas which have in the past been fruitful. But yet we have pockets of people who have almost, it's almost an anti-type of the covenant, but they have rejected God to the third and fourth generation. And there is a hardness there. You're conscious that our battle is not against flesh and blood. How do you do a Willow Creek in places like Strathpeffer, Crieff itself, areas of Scotland which are barren, like Ezekiel? We turn back after surveying the valley of dry bones. Lord God, you alone know. And then we start to speak to the bones on behalf of God. What about the positive elements? Well, there is a great danger in throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And I believe that there are, I think, a few positive elements that we can learn from Willow Creek. First of all, it can provoke a longing for growth. The man who goes along to Willow Creek meetings are well motivated. He wants to see his church grow. Now again, in some of the circles that I come from, I believe, and I have heard it articulated, that they have no desire to grow. And sometimes, the smaller, the better. And indeed, the more faithful you are, the smaller and smaller your congregation gets. It's the telephone kiosk mentality. Now, I'm not talking about a remnant theology. God will always have his remnant. Sometimes, and we have seen this in churches, sometimes people cannot take the sting of the gospel and they leave before the church grows. But even then, sometimes you have church growth, because you can have a church with 300 people. And then after 3 years of ministry, you have 200 people. But you started and there were only 50 Christians. They're born again people. And 3 years later, you have 75 born again people, although you've got 100 less folk in the pews. That's not what I'm talking about. But a philosophy that says the smaller the better, amongst the vows which a free church minister takes, I guess you guys take similar ones. It's the one, this one causes me to pause the most. Are not zeal for the honour of God, love to Jesus Christ and desire of saving souls your great motives and chief inducements to enter into the function of the holy ministry, and not worldly designs and interests? Is that the one that causes you to ponder and pause? And before we belt out, I do, we think about it. Now, I would like to hear some views on the following statement. The following statement is, there is something wrong with a church which does not grow. Throw that out to you. There is something wrong when a church does not grow. The normal situation is the growing situation. I think we'll get some feedback on that later. The problem is that we often personalize this. We say the problem is the minister. Now, that's sometimes the case. Not always. Robert Murray McSheen said this: "If my ministry were unsuccessful, if God frowned upon this place and made my message void, then I would willingly go, for I would rather beg my bread than preach without success." But he adds a little comment which I think is significant: "But I have never wanted success." John Angel James said, "Are we often seen by God's omniscient eye, pacing our studies in deep thoughtfulness, solemn meditation and rigorous self-inquisition, and after an impartial survey of our doing, questioning ourselves thus: is there no new method to be tried? No new scheme to be devised to increase the efficiency of my ministerial and pastoral labors?" Angel James is saying, I'm asking myself every day, is there not something I can do? They say we need better men, not better methods. And that's one of those phrases that's thrown out without any qualification. But this man says, are there better methods? Now, the church in the New Testament grew. Some of you will say, well, Acts was not normative. Tell me why it wasn't normative. There was a slow growth rate during the ministry of Jesus, a revival situation like Pentecost, and during Paul's missionary journeys, the growth varied from a few prominent women to hundreds. Growth metaphors are used: the body, agriculture. Paul may plant, Apollos may water. God gives the increase. Does that not suggest that the normal situation is the growing situation? Now, again, we've got to define normal there. What if the blessing of God is removed? What if God has bring an element of chastening into the life of a parish? So that's the first positive element. It can provoke a longing for growth. Willow Creek stimulates within us a desire to see our church grow. Secondly, very briefly, it helps us look in our own ministry at possible growth inhibitors. Shell Oil, when they employ someone, they say, we look for folk with helicopter vision. And the image is this: that you're in a traffic jam, and you just can't get out, you can't see a way out. And Murray Firth Radio doesn't really have a helicopter that checks the traffic jams. There aren't many traffic jams in Koboki, but Radio Clyde have this helicopter which rises up and surveys round about. And that's what Shell says, helicopter vision. The man that can rise above and just look at the problems. Well, surely a pastor does not want helicopter vision, but he wants God's vision. Willow Creek's best insights are frankly not original. You could save yourself a lot of money by going elsewhere. A few folk in this room could, I'm sure, tell you about Willow Creek a lot cheaper and a lot quicker. Their best insights are not the original ones, but when they articulate biblical principles in the language of today. Now, I sometimes feel as if I'm a needle stuck in a record here. But remember what Willow Creek says: we believe that a church should be culturally relevant while remaining doctrinally pure. We can't seem to get this balance. On the one hand, there are men who want my friend Coco the Clown from the States to get their people splitting their sides. And on the other hand, we get men whom you almost think they want to rip out electricity in their church. I saw an advert in a certain magazine recently, and it was advertising this church. And the bottom says, we don't even have a sound system. That's minimalism for you. But isn't there somewhere in the middle? Willow Creek goes off in the wrong direction. I'm going to apply it again briefly. This is my third third time I've said it briefly. First of all, apply it to our preaching. Preaching is, I believe, the key. The key. And this is where the balance is not seen. Culturally relevant while remaining doctrinally pure. We cannot seem to get it right. Now, we have the great Puritan tradition, for example, and folks say, oh, that's all pie-in-the-sky stuff. And yet these were the guys who worked out their theology against the anvil of civil war, against the anvil of incredibly high infant mortality, against the anvil of personal desperate straits. And there is so much to learn from the giants of the past. Richard Baxter. He is a tremendous church growth strategist. I suppose Kidderminster was the Willow Creek of his day. But again, sometimes I see the same problem here. I know a guy, and what he did was, he bought a big pile of catechisms, very laudable, and he handed them out to the people, and he started going round catechizing them. Now, what's he done? He's taken a Kidderminster idea, but he has not applied it culturally to his own situation. Actually, I think you can learn far more about church growth from Baxter's Reformed pastor than you can from an hour of Mr. Hybels. Okay, it might take a bit more work, but A, it's cheaper, and B, it will have a very profound impact if we read it in our knees before God. Didn't Baxter in one occasion have that marvellous expression about, he says, sermons ought to contain time bombs. What did he mean by that? He says, as you preach, you sow things in folks' minds, and during the week, the bomb goes off in their mind. Yes, that's what the minister was preaching on Sunday. Just time bombs that go off all the way through the week. The Gaelic-speaking folk talk, they have an expression which says that the sermon follows you. And that is a marvellous idea about a sermon following you all week. John Owen spoke about screwing the word into our consciences. But why the Puritan language? Did I see a man recently ordering buckled shoes? The Puritan philosophy and theology, the great Reformed system, which is second to none, the doctrines of grace. There's power. But can we not get them into the marketplace? New Testament was written in Greek. What sort of Greek? Koine Greek. Read Paul. Talk about seeker sensitivity. Mars Hill, the Areopagus. This was a guy who scratched where it itched. Instead of answering questions that nobody is asking, Paul was someone who had surveyed. He didn't need to do a survey, but he knew where his people were thinking, and he preached into their situation. I like the quote that John Stott has in his book in preaching. I think it's David Reed who wrote it. He says, it remains an axiom of Christian preaching that the road from study to pulpit runs through a living, demanding, interrupting manse, out into the noisy street, in and out of houses, hospitals, farms and factories, buses, trains and cinemas, up between rows of puzzled people to the place where you're called to preach. For the living word, there is no bypass road from study to pulpit. Churches surely will grow if there is animated, powerful, biblical, authoritative, exegetical, applicatory preaching. There is in the bookshelf a book called by David Eby, Power, Preaching and Church Growth. There are only three of them, I think. Maybe some of you know the guy, so I won't say too much. But shall we say, it's an excellent book and well worth buying. And probably one of the best elements in it is that each chapter has got the most amazing compendium of quotes. Incredible. The man must have done a tremendous amount of work. The book is buying for the quotes. If anything else, it's worth buying for the quotes. And it's a book that will inspire you to regain confidence in preaching. And so, it helps us to look at possible growth inhibitors. Applying this to our preaching, are we preaching? Fire in our belly. Logic on fire. Surely that makes church grows. Secondly, can we apply it to our corporate ministry? Churches grow where there is a culture of evangelism within the congregation. I look in many of my own folk look rather critically at our local charismatic fellowship. There are things that we say, oh, don't like that. But they've got people who love Jesus. They've got people who talk about Jesus in a way in which I wish that my people did. How seriously are we taking our role as pastor teachers to prepare God's people for works of service? Ephesians 4:12. Willow Creek again has put evangelism on the agenda. Growing churches put a high emphasis on evangelism. I know several growing churches. One, let me think of a couple. Pontefract Evangelical Church. Some of you may know. A congregational church in West Yorkshire in a little town. What are they there? They're obsessed with evangelism. What have they seen? They have seen phenomenal growth. Maybe not Willow Creek standards, but they have seen folk converted, changed. Lots of churches like that. I know another church in Liverpool. They got notice that they had to move out of the school. They were selling the school. They bought the school. It's growing. But we look at these churches and we say, but we're in Presbyterianism. Can we get these things working? I view Presbyterianism. There are low Presbyterians and high Presbyterians, by the way. I view Presbyterianism as a shipyard. Sometimes a shipyard is running to under capacity. And what you have is you've got the old gantries, you've got the old cranes, and in their day they lifted a great weight. We have that in our churches, presbyteries. In the Free Church, we have deacons' courts, kirk sessions. You think, why did Thomas Chalmers revive the deacons' court? The deacons' court had sort of fallen into obeisance. Chalmers had this burning heart for evangelism and social ministry, and he saw this gantry, this crane called the Deacon's Court, and it was rusty. It hadn't been used for years, and so what he did was he got the oil out and he got it working again. Presbyteries, centres for mutual edification. Isn't that what our John thought he was bringing to Scotland? Presbyteries, furnaces for ideas, places where our cold hearts would be warmed and we would leave leaping and rejoicing. Kirk sessions, ideas factories. I have a guy that says, all we've got to do is knock the old walls down. Now, I don't mind knocking a few walls down, a few partitions here and there, but some of the walls are load-bearing walls. You knock them down, the whole lot will come down. Believe it or not, I see these tremendous structures as potentially load-bearing walls. I think just now they're rusty old cranes. But under God, surely we can pray and work and get involved and get them working. Finally, we can apply this to individual attitudes. Churches grow with certain types of ministers. not the cold, calculating professional, but the man with a warm heart who loves Christ and loves his people. Kathleen Heisman said in her classic study in English Nonconformity, Charles Booth was of the opinion that the average working man would have little to do with the church or chapel, not because he really believed in free thought, but because he despised the professionalism of the clergy. Why are we not reaching the working class? My parish is incredibly cosmopolitan. Suburbia, but it's got everything. It's got really mega expensive houses. It's got Barrett stuff, wimpy stuff, upmarket stuff, council housing estate, the whole lot. We are just not reaching the working class. 78% of our communion roll are graduates. That's not reflecting the community. Something wrong there. And that story is repeated in many urban situations. I hope we'll get some discussion here. We are not executives, but servants. We are not power brokers, but doormats. May God give us the grace to be crucified men, preaching a crucified but risen Saviour. Thank you. Oh yes, it was something along the lines like the normal church is the growing church, and that there is something fundamentally wrong if your church is not growing.
True or not?
True or false?
First, define growth carefully. And I'm not talking about numbers.
I'm saying that that's part of my definition. I'm talking from the Acts passages. A deepening and growing in faith, plus a growing in... well, the church being added to, I would define as people being saved, to use good scriptural language.
Can I just ask you to clarify one or two things?
I hate when folks say that sort of thing.
Well, maybe fill out one or two things then.
That's worse.
Said, I'm sure you're delighted to hear that. No, I was very encouraged by what you said in terms of your critique of Willow Creek and things that we can learn from the creek. But I'm actually more interested in those two churches that you mentioned near the end of your talk that seem to be knowing growth. Now, I'm sure there's an emphasis on the preached word of God. I would be interested to know what forms of evangelism or evangelistic outreach those people have involved themselves in that have brought that kind of growth to them. Now, we know how Willow Creek do it. I would like to know how those two churches could you give us just some insight to that?
Right. I can think of lots of churches. The two I'm thinking of, Garstenbridge Chapel, it's an independent church in Liverpool, and Pontefract Evangelical, they're actually quite different. Pontefract would have a great... what they do each year is, and they've done this for 23 years now, 25 years, is they have put out to the whole town a pamphlet each year, Faith for Our Times it's called, and it's got testimonies in it of the ordinary folk in the church who've come to Christ. Now, they've been doing this solidly for 25 years, and they have a mission twice a year, and they have incredible number of folk come along. I was preaching there, I preached there three times now, and for example,
the minister there, Bill Dyer, he says, we're having coffee mornings every morning. So I thought, well, coffee morning, you're going to have a chic hall, you know, you're going to have a little daffodil on the table and all this stuff. We're into this ancient nonconformist, English nonconformist chapel with rows and rows of seats. Everyone sat in the pew and we drank coffee and I preached for half an hour and the folk just, you know, each preacher who came, you couldn't give them enough, and these were folk off the streets just drinking it in. Now that breaks all the church growth rules in a sense, doesn't it? But yet, what I think they have there is two things. They have a congregation with a real, a sheer evangelistic culture. And that the magazine will be distributed and folk in each street will go to the church and they witness. They are incredible. In that church, they covenanted 3 years ago to have a prayer meeting every night. Now, it's not attended by everyone in the church, but every night in life, people are praying. The church leadership meet every Monday morning, 6 o'clock, for business. They had last year what they called a solemn assembly, where the congregation met together and repented of various sins and covenanted together to be holy before God. And that, to me, was very, very impressive. Garstenbridge would have, again, the same evangelistic culture and this desire for the preaching to be contemporary and earth and individual. Now, there's other examples of church growth. One from the Free Church situation, Ruskeen Free Church. Now, it grew from about 60 up to 300 plus. Two stages. First of all, they had one minister, John Mackay, you know, Professor John L. Mackay, who really fed the folk. They had Kenny MacDonald, who is a very well-known character, who had a story to tell, a charismatic personality, and it grew under him. Now, in a sense, it breaks all the church growth rules. It's in the wrong place. It's in the middle of nowhere. Well, not that Andy from Invergordon would say it's nowhere, but it's not even near a town. It's just the main road. Authorised version, clerical collar. Kenny used the wrong sort of language, as the church growth would say, quite flowery, old-fashioned language of signs. That's the same man, yes.
And the chains and beer.
Yeah, that's it. But again, it grew. And I think one of the reasons there was the humanity, as I say, the incarnational ministry that Kenny had. Now, what I was interested in Ruskeen was, you had a very high-profile, charismatic minister, charismatic personality, that is. We don't have charismatics in the future. And I was interested, when he left, wow, would it nosedive? But another lad came, a younger lad, Derek. He's probably, in many ways, a more substantial preacher. But yet the growth has been maintained and continued. Now, I think that's healthy because it's not based. A lot of growth is based on personality. These are the various models. But again, each situation is different. I think, again, two things. There are certain things that happen. If you see a growing congregation, there are certain benchmarks, and you've got to ask yourself, why is that growing? What can we learn? But if you take that too far and try and take the package and apply it to your own situation, you know, that's wrong. But there are certain things that we can learn.
I don't know anything about the Gastonbridge situation you just mentioned, but I have heard that they've got a huge social program.
Yeah.
You haven't mentioned.
That's right, yeah. They would run workshops for divorce recovery and stuff like that. And a tremendous ministry it's an incredibly deprived area, and it's reaching into working class people.
That's important, isn't it? That is mentioned in the balance picture.
I think so, yes, absolutely. And one of my great heroes, of course, is Thomas Chalmers, and that was very much part of his evangelistic method in the reviving of the Deacon's Court. See, that's fallen into abeyance in the Free Church now. Deacon's Courts are about painting doors and drains, when really they were originally about, you know, social action, about education. Chalmers started wash houses in Edinburgh and stuff like that.
One of the things that I've been thinking about is that
One of the things that never gets mentioned when you're talking about a church growth is that in many churches where there's real growth, the churches don't get enormous because people get called out into Christian service and they go on and they go off to become missionaries or they go off to work somewhere else. And so it's not all about numbers. The New Testament in Acts, you know, trying to suggest that all the believers stayed in the same place and formed mega churches. They were scattered about all over the place preaching the word, and that's something I think that's enormously overlooked. Many more churches would be considered to be growing churches if we realize that.
Yes, I think my definition would include folk being converted. I'm not saying church growth is bodies in the seats, but I'm saying people converted. Nobody's yet answered the question, is a normal church a growing church or a growing church normal?
Yes, I can't answer the question. I don't want to stand as an advocate for Willow Creek, but I have read a number of articles on it and tried to look into it a little bit. And I wonder if what you said about pragmatism, if Bill Hybels was here trying to answer for himself, if he'd agree with that, what has come across to me in my own investigations is that he has a kind of slogan, when the church is doing it right, or if the church is doing it right. He would quote Acts chapter 2, but he wouldn't stop at verse 42. He would go on to subsequent verses where they cared for one another, where they shared, and so on. And he would say, if your church is warm and sharing and reaching out in a compassionate way and building bridges with the community, then it's doing it right in accordance with Acts 42 to 47, then you'll get some growth and some life. Now, when you were referring to the pragmatism, you really just referred to verse 42 and mentioned those four aspects which are governed by the one verb. They were devoted to the apostles' teaching, to breaking of bread, and so on, to prayer. But he would want to take... Now, and being devil's advocate, and I'm wondering if he would stand by the pragmatic thing, and if he wouldn't emphasize more... the science of our congregation, to use a phrase that I heard earlier today.
I would say to him, yes, your words are fine, and indeed there's this paper he's produced, Myths About a Movement, Answers to Common Misunderstandings, where he tackles each of these things. But I would say again, look, what you're saying is not always what's coming across. Your method is your massage, I would say. In your very methodology, you are extracting the sting out of the gospel. So that's answering a different question, David. I would agree with that. If that's what he's saying, that is fine. Out of a growing, vibrant church, there is outreach into the community. The one church I mentioned, the Ruskin Free Church, they revived this Deacon's Court idea, and they employed a social worker who worked amongst the great problems in Easter Ross. And Pontefract, the church that I mentioned there, again, is an incredibly caring philosophy. Garstenbridge, they have that as well. And so I think that is a mark of a growing church. The people love one another and care for one another. It's more than a Sunday service, but it's a real... folk are living out the gospel in day-to-day experience.
See, if I can just follow on from that, and then I'll shut up. I'm concerned for quite a number of chaps that I know, both in Scotland and in Ireland, who are following up the Willow Creek thing and even going and visiting Willow Creek in Chicago. And they're trying to extract from it some elements that they might be able to apply. Now, my last comment is, I know one congregation that's tried to do this seriously, and the minister said to me, 3 years down the road, he's conning them. He started it from scratch. If you've got a history, you can't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I come into a new church plant, and which
in the Free Church context was quite rare. So I can appreciate that philosophy. When you have something brand new, it's easier to do certain things. What's happened there, though, in that church? How's it gone?
Well, I don't want to say too much. I don't want to. Well, they've had to stop, really. They had so many objections from older members, and they faced splitting the church. And I think the minister wisely felt that unity was a prime sort of responsibility to maintain the unity of his fellowship.
Is part of the Ian Murray, two Ian Murrays here, I'm one of them, isn't part of the problem where we draw the line between our biblical principles and good human caring practice, so that you have good Rotary clubs and good organisations that are welcoming, it's a pleasure to be there, it's not because they're based on the Bible, but the genuine human factors. It seems to me, Willow Creek and some of these other, they prosper in part because some of their human practices are good, and not to be confused with biblical principles. Well, it does seem to me very important, where do we draw the line? Because, for example, some of the places you mentioned in the Highlands, damp, cold churches, is it a biblical principle that we must meet in a damp old church because it's been there 100 years? Obviously it isn't. And I know the Garston Bridge Church well, and I would say the human factor is very strong there, and we mustn't depreciate that. I mean, it's part of God's world, and it's somewhat related to the question of buckles on the shoes, isn't it? I mean, that is just being inhuman to dress like a Puritan today. So it's that, but sometimes we fall into it because out of concern to be faithful to biblical principles, we're confusing where the line is. And so, and some of you know one of the Presbyterian churches in Southern Ireland, which has been greatly blessed. Over 90% of the congregation converted Roman Catholics. Well, they didn't come to church. They had to go to them, they had to use local hotels. And I would think in places like Strathpeffer, it's hopeless to think that people are going to come one day marvelously into those churches. It's not going to happen. And there isn't a biblical principle to say that's the only way we can do it.
I think that's marvelous. I think there's a book in that. I think you should pursue that. Seriously, I think you should pursue that stuff and develop it. Yeah, because the same God who gave good sense to the church is the same God who gave good sense to the world. Good sense is God's sense, and I think that's very true. But there is almost an honour in inefficiency in the church, and that folks suspect anything that's nice and clean. And Philip.
David, you spoke earlier about the agricultural metaphor, really, yes, over against the mechanical metaphor. And of course, the agricultural metaphor speaks of growth. But Paul also used the metaphor of building. And he said, I laid a foundation. And the big thing about laying a foundation is that you're not going up, you're disappearing down a hole. Now, how would you apply that metaphor? Down the hole before you start to build up.
Right. Down the hole as opposed to up the creek is an interesting thing. Yes, again, I think that's part of the church growth process, and that there is an element of purging often has gone and real pain, and I think that's a valid metaphor. Again, that's bringing out the whole definition of church growth. One man may not in his ministry see the whole picture. And indeed, it sometimes takes years to see the whole picture of church growth.
Philip,
that's gentlemen, the other Philip, very
right,
persistent.
You confused me when you said we'll take Philip, because you're pointing straight at me as well. You asked the question, ought churches to be growing? And we would all love to see them grow, and we take your point about there is growth in an individual who in the past fell for temptation is now resisting it, an individual who didn't love neighbours and is now loving the unlovable, and so on. There's so much in the way of growth. That one bit of answering your question has to go to the logical conclusion What happens when the whole village is saved? Okay, we're a long way short, but we can't define the church as saying the only way we've got the real church is if it's growing, if we have reached saturation point. So that I would say a church has to be loving, has to be worshipping God. There are lots of words that we would want to see as describing success. If that's
yes, but why are folk not being converted? Answer this question. Why are folk today largely not being converted in the numbers that they once were? Now, maybe someone will say, but that's not true. But generally speaking, why?
That was what I was coming to. The Lord gave us two lines that come to mind in context of your question. One was, where two or three are gathered together, I am there in the midst of them. And there can be a wonderful, real church, even though it is small. And the other is, the parable of the sower warns us that a terrible lot of that seed got wasted. There was a bit that bore fruit, and I think we should be seeing growth. But we should not necessarily categorize a successful church by growth in whatever way we try to measure it. It is faithfulness that we're called to. And I'm well taught by my minister, faithfulness in preaching and faithfulness as congregations seek to be God's people. And I think that's more important than...